steps, really. The first thing that tends to happen on your machine is that the firmware gets loaded. That's the BIOS on a PC machine. Firmware can be big, it can be small, it varies. But the firmware part is control for the bootloader, which is usually loaded off disk, and the bootloader's job is to load the kernel. In our world, this is a kind of large piece of software. It runs completely in sort of protected mode on the CPU, so you can kind of, you don't want to run things like a web server in the server, your kernel, so you have a user space. The kernel has to start user space somehow, so it runs a program called init. Init is a process ID 1. It can never die. If init dies on your system, bad things can happen. The kernel actually will just boot and panic at that point and won't carry on. This is actually for various reasons. Because init is process 1, it becomes the parent of any process that has its parent has died. So all the daemons on your system, init is actually the parent of those. So when it has to be the process that reaps those children, it's quite important that init is actually running for this reason. And init has various special semantics as a result. So go on to a little history lesson of how we kind of boot a machine up with init. Init gets loaded, process ID 1. But init's job, therefore, is to start everything else, including like terminals to log in and all the daemons and services you actually want to be running. It does this, at least in the olden days, by running a shell script called etcrc, depending how you pronounce it, which is just a very long, kind of complicated shell script that goes off and does everything, mounts the disk, starts the network cards, so you know, configures the interfaces, starts all the services that need to, the daemons that need to be running. On things like OpenWRTs and embedded devices, that's actually still a very simple shell script, usually. And one of the things that it also has to do is run Getty or ET or anything complicated. Sometimes that was in the RC script, sometimes it was in the init daemon itself. This problems with these, quite myriad. It's quite easy to write, but it's not very maintainable. It's very difficult, for example, to have a package like Apache be installed and actually go ahead and modify this single one big RC script to kind of make it so Apache gets started. So what came along there is things like BSD came along, and they generally the RC script did something like have a directory instead, so you have an RCD directory. And mostly this is the RC script iterates this directory, and it can run lots of individual scripts in this directory one at a time, waiting for each one to finish before running the next, which gives you multiple shell scripts and is much easier to maintain. Apache can install scripts into that directory, and so on. System 5, slightly different. The System 5 gives you multiple profiles, or run levels, as it calls them, where you can have 5 or 6 run levels. The support switching between these run levels, instead these directories gain start scripts and stop scripts, sort of beginning S and beginning K. They're generally the same shell script and receive an argument to tell it whether the system is going up or down. This is kind of the idea that allows switching between the run levels, and it also allows kind of the system to be start up and shut down by switching run levels. But otherwise, it's basically the same system. So that, the only difference between that and that is that one has sort of start and stop at the front, one doesn't. And that's pretty much where we are today. I mean, it's both simplified, but it gives you a basic outline of what most of Linux distributions are shipping. Start off in run level 2 or 3, you run each of the scripts in that directory in order, waiting for each one to complete before moving on to the next one. So you get pretty much a boot chart. Everyone probably has done anything with boot, but is pretty familiar with one of these. And you get a boot chart which looks a bit like that. Init is the process that starts, it's running all the time. It starts individual scripts like RCS or RC2. Those iterate those directories running each of them in order. So in this case, we have new dev, mount, and network being run under RCS. And then we switch into run number 2, and we run into the dbus, hal, Apache, GDM. But you notice things like we're having to wait for Apache to finish starting before we can start GDM in this model, which is vaguely inefficient. It's worked for quite a long time, though, so you know, it hadn't really needed changing. And again, this is sort of very, very oversimplified. If you actually look at the one, for example, on Ubuntu, there's probably about 80 to 120 different processes being started on boot, and many of them are long-lived. And I've just omitted the detail to give you an idea of that one starts after the other and kind of goes on down, and that there's dependencies there we don't really want. So, booting isn't everything, though. We actually, in a modern system, have a bit more reactive, and you might have things like ACT-P scripts. So when ACT-P events on the battery going low or going on AC power happens, you want to run different scripts. You have things like the network card coming up and down, you want to run different scripts. And every application that does this at the moment implements its own script dispatcher. So you have etc/ACT-P scripts, you have etc/ATM-event.d, you have etc/debug-event.d, you have a whole myriad of, you have a whole myriad of different directories with each one with different rules. So the, you know, things in etc/rcd, those, if they're in .sh, get run differently to not ending in .sh, but for things in etc/APM, they might have to run ending .sh and so on. There's all sorts of different rules and behaviors. So this was something we've been considering suboptimal for quite a long time now, and generally really kind of, it was one of those things that's been nagging to fix, but probably not high priority enough to just do it on its own. And then, you know, so sometimes you have things like, I mean, the one I can think of is the alpha library, where we have to save and restore the mixer settings. So sometimes these, you know, ACT-P scripts, we call the init script, telling it to start the service, sometimes we say tell it to stop the service. So, you know, it's sometimes these actual dispatcher scripts just call the init script. And there's kind of bad things happen. We had several problems where a script would be called with stop at the same time as it was being called for start for a completely different reason. So you try and restore and save the mixer settings at the one time, or you try and start and stop Apache at the same time, or any silly little things like that. So what happens if you do that? Bad things happen. See ya. It doesn't actually do that. We're not claiming responsibility for exploding Dells, but it kind of, the things to go wrong, you end up with a sound card that, for whatever reason, when you boot, is muted when it was completely fine, when it shut down last time and it was, the volume was set. You end up with just little annoying things. But the trouble with annoying things is one annoying thing is just annoying. 100 annoying things over a period of 2 weeks can actually leave you feeling a bit of taste in your mouth. You don't want to use Linux. It's not as good as Windows. You know, we're trying to get users from all walks of life to kind of use it. And being sort of their laptop not quite functioning perfectly, it wasn't really useful. So this is kind of something we wanted to fix. But it was only kind of building up. We were actually looking at doing this just by kind of some better wrapper on any scripts and so on. It wasn't really sort of a big thing for us. However, there is another thing that was kind of a completely separate topic of conversation, a completely separate set of problems that we had to address, and these two combined a bit later. So, so we have this problem of tasks. Tasks are things like mounting a direct disk, things like saving a mixer state, and they can be started at any time, and they run until they stop, and they run because something happens to the system. And then we have services like Apache, which are respawned when they die if you want to, you know, running on the system in a particular state. Just put those two sides in it just to define the term. They caught me by surprise because I moved them this morning. That's the computer kind of most Unix users were using 30 years ago.
Nice surprise themselves with a couple of
people in the room. The lovely PDP-11. The interesting thing about the PDP-11 was they did actually have removable disk drives. Yeah, you could take the disk out and plug it back in again later. Admittedly, they had to generally be least powered off with the patched first. So, you know, 30 years ago, we had big monolithic computers that didn't really change that much. 20 years ago, it was an Apple II, or an IBM PS2. Again, they're not really computers that changed that much. The PS2 is interesting, simply because it had detachable keyboard and mice like on the bus, but especially the early PS2s, if you've been plugged on top of the keyboard while it's running, it could actually fry the motherboard, so it wasn't something you'd actually consider hot plug, at least not for the normal definition of hot. And even if we look at 10 years ago, I'm not actually sure this one's 10 years old, but it was kind of Google Images thought it was, so this is, but you can see it's pretty much a modern computer. It, you know, we've got sort of images sort of that we can start to see things we're used to seeing now, like there's a CD drive in there, there's the PCI cards. It's not actually hot swappable yet, it's not, you can't detach and unplug things. And we get to see our first laptops 10 years ago in common use. But again, these are quite bulky, quite single entities that kind of don't change that much. But today, this is actually my laptop, we have like a little bit more of a difficulty dealing with hardware. For example, your keyboard and your mouse might be USB connected, so they can be plugged in and unplugged at any time. And you can have multiple keyboards, you can have multiple mice, and you can have little preventer gadgets that appear as a mouse for a while or a keyboard for a while, so you can wander around without touching your laptop or doing talk. So you know, those continuously appear, they disappear. You have removable storage, which is not necessarily a disk. These are things that you know, we're so used to using. It's probably the one device that killed the floppy disk is the USB key, you know, which can be detached and plugged in and unplugged at any time. And some people actually try and have root file systems on these things, or at least slash home on these things. It's very common. You also have other forms of removable storage or removable media. So you have an iPod there, which is appears generally the file system with some interesting semantics. We also have removable sound cards. We have removable sort of, so removable sound card example is actually a headset, because a USB headset appears to us as a sound card. We also have digital, so yeah, FireWire devices like cameras. This, you know, that's just on a typical laptop. There's just there's me getting around the ports on that laptop there. There's also SD cards, and then there's PCMCIA PC cards, which can be detached and attached at any time. It's got a Wi-Fi kill switch to actually, which actually detaches devices from the internal bus and reattaches them again. It's pretty hairy, and then just to make matters worse, there's an entire separate PCI bus you can plug the laptop into when you get home, which adds even more devices to it, like CD-ROMs and stuff, and actually literally is a PCI hot plug device. So we can, you know, we're literally removing hardware cards. So modern machine is a little bit more complicated than ones we had sort of 30 years ago. So we kind of have this problem. The particular problems we were kind of facing was, as I said, home is on a USB key. This is actually quite common. A lot of people have like encrypted home on their USB keys now because they can plug it in into any of their three machines, four machines, wander it around. But of course, the problem with home being on a USB key is, you know, the person boots the machine without, when it forgets to plug it in. If the machine reaches the point where it tries to mount the file systems, it will just stop. It will probably crash. It will give a shell prompt or ask for the root password to go into maintenance mode. What it won't do is recover nicely if they found the USB keys and down the back of the sofa and actually plug it into their computer. Yeah, there's another problem. User is on a network file system. Quite common in sort of server environments. It's probably a little less common now than it used to be, but it's still common. But users on a network file system, and the network card's removable. PCMCIA card, network card, user on a remote file system. You've got to bring it up in the right order. You've got to hope the PCMCIA card kind of comes up in time. You've got to hope it's plugged in. Otherwise, you're just going to fail to mount slash user. You're not going to carry on. SCSI RAID hardware nowadays takes a while to initialize. The SANs take ages to initialize. You know, you start with Matthew Wilcox, who's going to be doing a tour, a little lecture talk a little later about why SCSI probes and stuff take so long when they're asynchronous and stuff. So that will kind of fill you in some of the kind of crazy buses and stuff that are being dealt with now. And these things, you know, from a user space point of view, we load the SCSI module and kind of kick our heels around for up to 3 minutes waiting for some disks to appear. And, you know, that's a while loop with sleep statements in it because there's nothing else we can do. I mean, Ubuntu Edgy does have this while loop in its RAM there. So we have kind of these problems. I mean, here's a really, really nasty one. Network card, PCMCIA network card needs firmware to be uploaded, or, you know, the IPW in my laptop or your laptop, the Atheros, anything like that. They need firmware to be uploaded. And to get on the network, it needs to negotiate WPA because it's a secured wireless network. DHCP actually takes a little while after that. Server's under heavy load. And all of these things need to come together for a single server. You might be running a squid proxy on your laptop to bind to that network interface. If all of these things haven't happened during the boot sequence by the time you try and start that server, it will just fail to start. And it won't be restarted if this has happened. You know, if the DHCP comes up after you're logging into GNOME on your laptop, that doesn't mean Squid will then get started. It actually means Squid has failed to start. You've got to go investigate why, and so on. These are kind of suboptimal things. So we have these kind of two conversations going on in parallel. We have this whole, we don't really like the fact we're dealing with these shell scripts that start services, stop services, doing the hard work themselves, and we're running them from about 18 different locations, sometimes with no locking to prevent us running the same ones at the same time. They're difficult to configure. And the second set of problems, which is the fact that when we boot a machine, it's very hard for us to boot a machine and get it up perfectly without any race conditions, without anything clashing, without anything sort of sticking over each other, basically. So, two problems, and you know, we're having to deal with. So we looked at sort of the new init daemons to replace this. So, hands up if anyone's here has heard of init-ng, which is a dependency-based init daemon. So, excuse me. And hands up if anyone's heard of Solaris's SNS, the service management program, which is another dependency-based init daemon. So, I'm using init-ng there, just picking on it, because I found its logo, which is actually a really great logo. I really do like that logo. just kind of So how do these things work? Well, dependency-based init daemons, the way they work is a bit like package managers, really. You have to have a list of goals of what you want to be started on your system for it to know what it needs to start. So in the case of initng, these basically the run levels are the list of packages, list of jobs that you want to be started as part of that run level. In some SMF, it actually the goal is anything in your services configuration which isn't manually disabled. So first of all, you get this list of goals. Goals have dependencies. So you know, Apache needs the networks, GDM needs to mount the disks because you need to actually use them and stuff like that. And you know, those dependencies can also have dependencies. In this case, in a Linux system, both the dependencies there would be UDEV because we need something to get the devices off the kernel. So then what happens is it calculates these dependency trees, which gives it an order it can start services. So it can start UDEV, it can start network and mount GDM in parallel, fortunately, so it's, we've reduced the boot time a little bit, and we can now start Apache and GDM. So that's how a dependency-based init daemon works. The problem with that is that doesn't actually solve any of the problems we're trying to solve. They've set out to try and solve the problems of ease of administration, so you can just drop your service in and list the services it depends on, and it works out what order to start things, and the problem with boot speed, because you know, it automatically orders it in the most efficient manner, in theory, to actually boot it fastly. We don't really care about that. We care a little bit about that, but we've been tackling boot speed by a completely different method. So, you know, by actually looking at what we're doing in the boot sequence and trying to make sure we're not trying to do too much or too little, or too stuff in the wrong place. So it kind of didn't really fit in what we want to do. And here's why. We don't want to depend on UDEV. We want to depend on ES1. We want to depend on SDA1. We want to depend on things that were not definable as dependency jobs in a dependency-based init system, i.e. in the NG or SMS. We want to define that depend on something that is fundamentally a hardware device. A hardware is not something that's ready on demand. You can't depend on ES1. You can kind of do it. You can write a job that sits there in a while loop until it shows up and kind of releases when it's ready and so on. But it's not really an efficient way of doing this. You can kind of mash it together, but not really. Now, the interesting thing is, this thing's already solved. Anyone who saw David Boykin's talk earlier will have a much better picture of how this works. But this is a very simplistic overview of the kind of the Project Utopia stack that we've been using in Linux for a while now. The kernel can send events to UDEV. We call UEvents these days, which has replaced the SBIN hotlog wrapper. UDEV can do things like call modpro to load kernel modules. It can also inform how of these kind of events. So how gets on a socket the event from the kernel and tells it what to do. It can send the message over dbus, so the sys puts it onto the system bus. That message can go to the session bus and so on. So in both from the system bus and session bus, various policy managers, policy agents, and hardware managers can actually respond to these dbus messages. And also these kind of processes can also directly talk to the kernel with methods, things like inotify, K events, following future kernel patches and so on. So we actually have a lot of rich events now about what kind of things are happening on the system. So, you know, let's take you through a typical example of a series of these events we get. Just to give you the idea of the path. We get a message from the kernel telling us the PCI device has been added. UDEV calls modpro. That loads a driver. That driver fires off a series of more events because now we have an actual network interface that ETH0 has been added. UDEV can tell how that ETH0 has been added, gives it the event. How it puts a debuff message out, saying there's a new network interface. Network manager receives that debuff message. It can call something like DH client. It can bring up the IP address and so on. It can configure WPA and everything on that interface. It can then inform the debuff again a message saying that ETH0 is now up. So we have an event-based mechanism living in place to do a lot of the physical stuff about hardware. We don't need to sit in while loops. We can just literally select until we get a debuff message. We can select until we get a message from UDEV or from the kernel. There you go. The thing again. In fact, there's actually several places we might want to conceivably start and stop services or run tasks on the system, which has been traditionally the kind of the purview of the init daemon. UDEV, there's actually a good compelling reason to run devices from UDEV, which we're getting to run sort of tasks and services from UDEV. How? Absolutely, definitely from how. Policy kits kind of simplified whether it's a, I think, I don't, I'm not sure what that is, but like, whether it's a kind of camera or things like that, and sort of with HAL. And we get messages via DBus from HAL. Network manager gives us messages on the, over DBus saying things like the network's up. There's a very rich source of these kind of events which would be useful to start stop services on the system and on different tasks. In fact, we can kind of isolate a whole bunch of them. UDIP, there's hardware, if it's, we get events, hardware is added or removed from the system. Also when kind of kernel objects like device mapping devices and stuff. So we can get very raw events telling us the PCI device has been added, a block device has been added, a hardware, sort of anything hardware as your networking space. And we can run really low-level things like HD palm out for utils, set the hardware clock and stuff in those kind of events. And these are things at the moment we try and do in the boot sequence by guessing how far into the boot sequence that's likely to happen, which is not very reliable. If we did it as a direct result of the UDIP event, you would have completely bulletproof mix of settings being saved in the story, bulletproof hard disk DMA getting enabled. The hardware clock would not kind of wander between UDC and not, depending whether you're using DHCP or not. From HAL, we can have hardware events with policy added to them. So telling us things about whether it's a default sound card, whether it's a digital camera, whether it's a device and the console user getting added. So at that point, we can run things like management daemons or printer daemons or so on. We can start and stop things because there's actual physical hardware there to, you know, for the service requires that hardware. Network manager, current power manager, current volume manager, all of these things, which are very rich source of events. Network manager, we can use the same events as other things like a legacy if up down on a Debian server. We can, you know, make those issue the same events to upstart in this case. And we can run things like syncing the network clock, mounting FSR systems, running network daemons that actually require to bind to a network port, that require to bind to an IP address that only exists once it comes up. We can stop them again when we pull the network card down. And Learn Power Manager is a little typical example there, but you can stop Beagle when you're on battery power just by changing your config option if you have one central service manager. So this is where we came up with this idea of an event-based init daemon. And these kind of combine all of these problems we've kind of been talking about and all of the kind of knowledge of what we're doing with UDIF and HAL and stuff these days. So event-based init daemon. It originally got called Wendy, but that was a really bad pun, so it got called Upstarting, and which is probably worse, but seems to actually fit it quite well. So we can use the same example as I used for NG, but show you how Upstart reacts to it. The first thing is it sends out a single event. It's an event-based system. It's a message kind of passing system in it. It sends out a single event. It's actually just called Startup. It's not very original. And as a byproduct of that event, or directly from that event, you might start UDEV, which is a service that gets started, it runs, and UDEV then starts receiving its kernel events, it starts kind of dispatching them. And from UDEV, depending on the event, you may have filters in place and UDEV rules, you may then transmit additional events into Upstart. One of the really basic goals we came up with was that Upstart would just have no knowledge of these events. It would be just literally define the format of them, which is just basically a string name, some arguments, and environment variables that go along with it. They look a little bit like UDEV events or HAL events. And that's it. It would then dispatch them and start and stop services or run tasks as a result. So UDEV can just sit there. It can select. It can receive events from the kernel. And depending on those events it receives, it can issue events saying since the block device has been added and a network card has been added. Upstart in this meanwhile is just waiting for events from UDEV. It can, you know, can pass these events to Upstart and say, this has happened. And then as a result of that, we can then mount the network, mount the disk, and start and then bring up the network card. So we now have a very event-based mechanism for bringing up mounting disk and network card. This would be, for example, disks that are mentioned in FTFS, network card mentioned in one Debian XT network interfaces. When you're in a desktop situation, sometimes these things, especially removable disks and pluggable network cards are better left to session policy daemons. They're good examples for the problem. And as a result of these kind of things, we can do Apache and GDM. It should be probably noted as well, the network there, we'd actually have it so the network events there could come from network manager, the mount events there could come from the volume manager. We'd use the same sort of events for this. So you start Apache and start GDM. One of the obvious advantages of this, if you didn't plug in SDA1, it doesn't matter. Because all you have to do is go find it, plug it in, and it will just resume. It will carry on down that right-hand branch, and then GDM will get started. If you don't have your network card plugged in, it doesn't matter. The minute you plug it in, it'll get processed, it'll get added to the system, you get an event, and that was token added, Apache will be started. And as soon as you pull it out, Apache will be stopped. This is assuming Apache listens on that blind port, for example. So we have this kind of very rich series of events, and we kind of came up with this init daemon based on this. There's kind of a whole thing going on for a little while once we announced it about dependency-based init daemons versus event-based init daemon.
This
event-based init daemon is very reactive. It reacts completely to your system. It brings up whatever your system is able to bring up. You can have jobs sitting there and services sitting there that don't come up simply because they're not needed for this computer. And it's very flexible. We can ship a default configuration that will work for everybody. Whereas on a dependency basis, you kind of have to tweak it a bit. But there's a lot of cons in mind, there's cons with it. And especially the big one is that an event-based system has no goal in mind. Whereas in FNG, you have a big list of services that you must start, and you can create a flexible error message that tells you why it's failed. In Upstart, it actually doesn't, because it kind of doesn't ever stop booting. It just assumes that the system is still booting and is taking a while. But that's actually not a bad thing, because it actually turns out displaying an error message on the console, given the boot shell, isn't necessarily the most useful thing you can be doing at that point. And in a typical sort of distribution environment, we'd ship a lot of things that made sure that if after a certain period you don't have a root file system, we can bring up useful messages telling people we haven't had a root file system. We can respond to failed events and tell them why it's not coming up. We can offer them root shells. And actually, by not having in our mind this idea of booting the system, by eliminating that entirely, by just saying that the system is booted when the kernel passes control to user space and everything else that happens just happens, we don't have this problem of, well, the system stopped booting, so now your USB disk won't get mounted until you log in. The system has finished booting, so now even if you plug in your network interface, you're not going to get all those services that network interface is actually using. So there was that comment, but we think that comment is completely subsumed by reactive hooking to these events. So that gives a kind of idea of what an event-based unit system is. So in an event-based unit system, or in any unit system, we'd define what we'd run. I mean, this is going to be an example of a service here. So we'd say we'd run a debug daemon to the system bus, and we want it respawned because we want it to die. Going back to the original first few slides, we already knew that we didn't want shell script starting, and we didn't want shell script stopping things because most of that code is copy and paste, so you may as well put that logic into the init daemon itself. This is most of them, like init and GSNS and launchd in the Apple case, behave like this. So it seems logical, and actually after much testing, it's exactly the right thing to do. The mistake some of them make is assuming that's all you need to do to run debuff. But actually, you need to run code to do things like make directories for it, set the permissions, remove, clean up things afterwards. So as well as actually giving a daemon or a binary we need to exec and monitor, we also have scripts around that. So you can even write that whole thing as a single shell script yourself, where that shell script shouldn't terminate until the daemon terminates. So we left the flexibility in there. The only thing you don't do, you don't write a script to start it, which terminates with it started, and a script to stop it, which terminates when it stops. You now write a script to get it ready to be started, get a script to clean it up after it's been stopped, and then kind of in the middle of it just say what you actually want Upstart to run directly itself for you. And it Upstart in the middle of it doesn't necessarily come out to us, but it's a state machine. The great advantage of having a state machine at the central of your init daemon is that even if you're halfway in the middle of the state machine, when you decide you want to start the alpha microservice, if you decide you want to stop it, we have a flexible method of getting back to stop. It looks really insanely complicated, but it's actually mostly kind of there's four states adopted. You're starting a service, you're stopping it, you started it, you stopped it. And the same is true for tasks. The only main difference is the tasks stop themselves. And for any given point on there, we can either leave it by a green arrow because we want it to be running, we can leave it by a red arrow because we now want it to be stopped. And
somewhere in there, it's on the top left, top one, in the middle.
The running diamond. You notice we can leave that via green and red arrows in two different directions because sometimes we want it respawned because it died and we didn't expect it. And sometimes we want to kill it and restart it. That's all that means.
So that's
just a state machine in the heart of that stuff. All it really is, it's a state machine which deals with processes and an event passing, so message passing thing. So within that state machine, we want to define a job. We said what it run, how it gets started, how it gets stopped. So we have to tell it what events we want to run it on. So we can give it very simply, the event name is just a string, FHSL, the mount in this case, the main user, bar, etc. all up, and stop on it when they all get unmounted again. These can kind of all together. So this isn't necessarily flexible. It's actually far better to define a state in which this is running. So we actually give it as a period between two events in this case. The advantage here is we can actually now say, so FHSL is mounted to FHSL system unmounted. Here, this event role is just generated by our default mount script. So it can be anything you like. But I think some policy and standards would be useful for an LSB or some similar level. So we can define that to say you can run the system. This would be traditional for multi-user mode. Or you can define network up and network down. The advantage of defining a state is you can combine the two. You can say this was running in the state, a typical DMIC like DDoS is running in the state when FHSL is managed, FHSL is unmounted. There's something like Apache or Squid, you might say from FHSL system mounted until FHSL system unmounted and network up until network down. So you union the two periods between the events and you can intersect them as well. You might, quickly over a couple of the other features. One thing is like how you can actually upstart support promotion of locking on events. So when you start and stop DDoS, it generates events, which how can then use. But with the special start stopping event, how can actually be stopped fully before DBus is allowed to continue stopping. So how can actually be ensured that it is completely stopped and shut down before DBus is sent the turn signal. The advantage of this simply is that you don't get a log error log in the how error log because DBus went away under it. And likewise, we have an equivalent starting event as well as to actually ensure that something is started before how is allowed to start, for example. So you can, and there's also obviously the started and stopped events which tell you that the service is gone or has arrived. But basically, kind of how you define it. You define a job, something that progresses through the state machine, and you define which events cause it to go which directions through the state machine. And just because we can define arbitrarily complicated periods in which a job can be run. This, for example, defines that a event of a user logging in during daylight hours, while there's an active network interface and the FHSL system is mounted. And that is just in one job. If you want that job also to be run hourly, you just add the word and hourly on the end of that. So there's one place you can figure when a service is run. You would never really use these, but it's an interesting stress test of the mechanism to invent things like this. That's our boot chart we've got at the moment.
One thing running at a time.
And the obvious advantage to having an event-based mechanism when things happen is you can actually eliminate all the white space. You can run things in parallel. When you just start, you can mount the network interface, mount the network drive, mount the network interface in parallel. You can start DBus, and you can start how DBM, you can start those in parallel with Apache. It reduces the time. In practice, this is a little bit of a lie, because if you're doing multiple things at once, they actually get a bit longer because you're time sharing at that point. But in general, this is the advantage of the modern DBMs you get, this reduction in boot time. And the principal advantage now for us is not this reduction in boot time, it's the massive increase in reliability. We know now that if your network interface comes up, we can stop things. So just give you a quick 5-minute overview of those.
About the development project,
which is probably 1 minute overview. Upstart 0.2. If anyone here is running Ubuntu Edgy, you are running Upstart today. We shipped it in Edgy. We made a little bit of fanfare about it. What we actually did there was we shipped it, but still running the existing RC scripts and still running the Gettys. So we literally just replaced the init daemon. The reason we did this was it's a great way to test something or be able to roll it, rip it back out again if it goes horribly wrong. And it was basically to prove the concept that an event-based init daemon can be flexible enough that it can emulate the existing one as well as doing all the new things while we test it. So it kind of had very simple things. If you use Edgy today, you can do init control list, start service, to start TTY1, stop TTY1, and so on. And it will do a shakedown. 0.3 or 0.5, whatever it's going to get called, will be shipped in privacy. Events are now more complicated. They have arguments and environment. We can define foo into a bar. We can join things foo and bar. And our plan for privacy is to have a native boot sequence using Upstart. So the RC scripts will only now be used for packages which haven't yet been converted to Upstart and third-party things which we're not, they won't convert just yet or
probably in a million years.
We retain that this 5-minute emulation forever. But we know we can tend to have this native boot sequence that's just purely event driven for Spicy, which releases in April.
Future plans?
I'll start one plan. Timed events, kind of basically quick on Anacron support, but in reality it makes a lot of sense, as well as being able to define calendar events together, define periods of 8 a.m. to 4 a.m. every day, 15 minutes after network up, every 15 minutes before network up. Yeah. It makes sense to define these things, and it's very low cost. Upstart already has to do timers to do send signals and stuff, so it's actually very cheap to add this. Things like INetD support, our general thought there is that it would be a separate process, because it's so cheap to send events to Upstart, would have a separate process of INetD listening, and it would just send messages to Upstart if it needs to start and stop services. But I don't think that's going to be probable for Upstart. I'm not entirely sure the level we really want that. It's kind of specialized. INet
encloses communication.
Right now we have an ITC mechanism, allows you to start, stop, create status for services. We're thinking of adding things like GPLIs and pings to that, so you can actually talk to the service and you get startup notification.
Yeah, that's what
Nokia wants for the kind of environment. And then obviously things like geographical service management UI to extend the existing kind of command line utilities. So that's kind of where we're going. I mean, that will be, Upstart 1.0 will be probably by the end of this year.
Because
that was the end of kind of the introduction and stuff. There's a website. There's more information on all the original documents we wrote, a mailing list. Upstart on Freenode is where we hang out to do development stuff, and there's a URL with the specifications and stuff we're targeting for the 0.3 release.
And the open
office crashed 3 times while I was doing this, so that's my first lens. So thanks very much, and I'll take some questions, I think. If you come down to the microphone, I should say, actually, if you want to do questions, because face this person running around all the time.
What communication have you had with other distros? I mean, I don't use many other distros, I don't have to, but what other distros have you talked to about getting them to use Upstart as well?
So yeah, what communication with other distros have? I actually, Upstart is one of my projects. Although I work as Ubuntu as a development manager there now, it was always one of my projects. And I actually emailed the original documents over to Red Hat, Fedora, all sorts of things, to Gentoo, and to Debian, and so on. So. I have that, they're all easily communicated. I've been sort of trying to talk to the distros and stuff. My sort of basic hunch is that they're waiting to see how well it works or how badly it breaks. I have an appointment to talk with David from Red Hat Fedora later today, hopefully about stuff and the overlap with some of the work he's been doing. So but there has been communication there, there still is communication there. Gentoo seems to be quite happy playing with it at the moment. So yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions?
What are you looking to probably do with things like the etc.init.d scripts that do reloads and restarts and things like that?
So restarts generally, restarts tend to be start-stop, but where it's not, the general plan is to add like the omission of actions, so as well as telling scripts start-stop, you can add an action there, which does something custom. To be honest, that's not highly specified yet. The Launchpad spec tracker is a great book, the wiki on the website. Help join in the development, so this is still 0.2, 0.3, so we're still developing it. And any ideas that anybody has on those kind of things that are missing, please come in and specify it. The other distributions should join in as well and can work out the best way of doing it.
So I'm using Upstart, and
yep.
I'm in a marginal Wi-Fi area, and I've got a lot of essentially route flapping. What kind of dampening do you put into that? A lot of network daemons flapping up and down.
Yeah, in that situation, if it's going up and down a lot, you get the rate limiting carriages hit that stops it despawning services too fast. Just basically lacking.
Is there any chance of having start and stops happening at the same time in
yeah.
that situation? So, I mean, it's...
So, no, because...
So the network interfaces come up, the starts are all running, there's lots and lots of daemons still starting, but the Wi-Fi goes away, the stops start to happen at the same time.
So no, one of the kind of the original kind of plans was to make sure that you couldn't end up in that situation where you had multiple things. So a job can only be one place in a state machine at one time. So if it's running
and it gets started
and a message comes in to get stopping, all that means is it follows the state machine in a different direction. So the daemon would probably get pre-started and stopped again. So you would kind of get some churn, and then obviously you'd have dampening code or rate-limiting code to stop it to run.
There is some rate-limiting code?
There is some primitive rate-limiting code in there at the moment. We'll add more as and when we find we need it, really. That's a small amount of code, so it's quite easy to extend at this point.
Great, this is the last question, thanks.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, I just had one as a user, as a laptop user, and one as an admin. For an admin, How would I have a service set up, like to start on a particular event? Like you said, there were just strings, but is there like a definitive list of what services define what strings? So I know like where what action should kick off my, say, server that I've written?
Yep, there's mechanisms for services to find which events they're met. We're probably going to recommend people write man pages for them as well. And there'll be kind of, when we add things like the UI and stuff, then we'll put kind of that sort of thing in there. Yep, that's
okay.
Definitely planned.
And can you also have it so that it's more, like you had, your example was that like you have something come up because Ethernet one's up. Can you have something just says network available? Is it like a more generic term?
Yeah, network up. It's one we're using at the moment.
Okay. Cool, thanks.
Right. So anyone else has any questions or wants to grab me, I'm here all week. I've had come up to the front and talk to me or kind of grab me just kind of when I'm wandering around between places, and we'll be completely happy to answer anything that you want to know and give you any demos and stuff. So thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you, Scott. Small gift for you for speaking today. A small gift for you. There you go.